helping girls become tomorrow's leaders.
They're going to be president, they were going to do everything. They got to middle school and their knees started shaking.
Plus, a think tank that focuses on food and some thoughts on International Women's Day. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. During Women's History Month, let's take a moment to consider what might hold women back from positions of leadership. For some, the turning point happens early. A psychologist was shocked at the loss of confidence her daughters experienced when they entered middle school. She co-founded the Young Women's Leadership Program at the University of Virginia, where college women pair with middle school girls to help them reach their potential. After more than a decade, the program is now a national model. Allison Quance has more.
When the college mentors of the Young Women Leaders Program get together with their middle school partners, they take it very seriously.
Okay, we'll start right here.
Ankle, booty.
Okay, maybe not that seriously. But one of the things that distinguishes the Young Women Leaders Program from similar programs is the amount of training the mentors are given.
Okay, guys, so start working on this sticky situation.
Part of the program is an actual college class taught by University of Virginia professor Winks Lawrence, where they discuss tactics for working with what they call their littles. For example, what do you do if your little is putting private information on her Facebook page?
What are the things you have to think about? Facebook stalking? All right, so safety. Right, her safety, that she's putting something out here so public about herself. Absolutely, right? That we don't want to...
This kind of training is important. Stephanie, one of the mentors, puts it like this.
So you don't want to be the parent, you don't want to be the friend, you want to be the mentor. So you got to be a little bit of everything at the same time.
Sometimes it means baking cake pops and talking about boys, or helping with homework and career planning. It can be hard to imagine the kind of honest relationship that the mentors say they have with their littles. So they invited us to a weekly group session held at Burley Middle School in Albemarle County.
Hey, everybody. You guys, who wants to lead highs, lows for me?
They start each session by going around the circle to say one good thing and one bad thing about their week. It gives the girls some support if there's something bad going on, but it also gives them a place to brag without looking stuck up.
My high is that I won nationals for cheerleading and...
Highs and Lows does a pretty good job of capturing what the Young Women Leaders Program is all about. It's women and girls celebrating each other's successes and helping each other through their problems.
My high is that I got a 95 on a math packet that I got.
That's a little, and here's a big.
My high is that I have a job interview tomorrow, so that's really exciting.
Both the middle school girls and the college women look forward to these meetings as a way to relax and unwind. It gives them stability at a time when a whole bunch of things in their lives seem to be changing.
My low is that I'm moving in a couple weeks, so that sucks, but yeah, just make the most out of it.
I'll miss you.
I'll miss y'all too.
That's Brittany. Her big sister in the program is Yoon Lee. They love the group sessions, but they really like to hang out one-on-one.
We are the international pairs. Both of our parents are from the military.
So we understand each other very much.
Yes.
We're practically sisters, just long lost.
Listening to Yoon Lee, you can tell that she has a lot of respect for Brittany.
The best thing I like to talk to her about is when we are facing something that we are anxious about. And sometimes I feel like I'm not that mature as her.
Live life to the fullest, and if you don't feel like you're doing the wrong thing, just stop, because you are. If your heart tells you that it's wrong, don't do it.
The Young Women Leaders Program was co-founded by Winks Lawrence, a professor and clinical psychologist at the University of Virginia. Why this particular age group? What are they, 12, 13?
They're between 11 and 13. We chose this age because it's really a transition. So they've come from elementary school where the world feels fairly safe. They're very connected with their teachers, to a world where everything is changing for them. So amongst all these changes, we wanted to provide some support for them to make healthy decisions. In middle school, girls begin to think that their moms are not as smart. So it's really nice for them to have an adult, other than their parents, that is a mentor to talk to work through these decisions.
What do you think is the key area you try to bolster? Self-esteem, I'm thinking?
Actually, it's not. Part of what we encourage the girls to do is begin to reconnect with the supports, the competencies in their life and in themselves that they've sort of lost track of. So we work at reconnecting them with their moms, reconnecting them with their dads, teaching them again how to connect with teachers and make use of teachers. Learning how to slow down and make use of these great brains they've got that they're actually maybe not using at the moment.
When you started to look at this group and think, I want to put something together, was it because you yourself had teenage daughters?
Two things. I'm a clinical psychologist, and so I was working with adolescent girls, mostly with girls in trouble in high school, so had gotten too far out on the skinny limb, using drugs or dropping out of school, getting involved in relationships that weren't healthy for them. And as I traced it back, I realized that they had started thinking about that during middle school and nobody was watching. So it made sense to come up with a prevention, not an intervention program. But I was also struck by my own daughters. They were so confident in elementary. They're going to be present. They were going to do everything. They got to middle school and their knees started shaking, and they were allowing boys to pluck their bra straps and talk meanly to them, and the girls were talking meanly to each other. And I thought, with all their privilege, well, how is it that they're not able to stand up for themselves? And why aren't they using the teachers more? Or why aren't they using me more? And as I investigated, I realized that I could have a college student giving the same advice that a teacher or a parent would give, and they would think that was cool and brilliant. College women are also wondering about, who am I? Who am I going to be? So they are perfect ones to talk to middle school girls about this.
What do you teach the college girls? This is a unique program because it's sustainable. They're taking a course with you for course credit, and you are giving them the tools to really competently interact with their little, as you call them.
Right. You know, one of the biggest things, we teach them how to be an active listener. Many of us think that listening is telling somebody what they need to do. And it's not. The hardest thing for us adults is to listen and keep our mouths shut and invite the young person to tell us what their thinking is, even when it seems a little wacky. So I teach them how to do that. I teach them how to problem solve with the little sisters in a respectful way. I teach them how to help the little sister find resources in their community to help them make healthy decisions. For example, a little is felt insulted by a teacher at school, and she wants to go off and call the teacher names and lose her temper. What we teach them is they then come and talk to their big sister about it, and the big sister listens first. She feels wounded, what that wound is about, but then how to go and talk to the teacher in a respectful way about her concerns so that the teacher and the little can then mend their relationship.
What else have the college women said to you? Came as a surprise that they were grateful for learning in the course of this sort of counseling component?
Well, I think they're always shocked that they learn as much, if not more, than the middle school girls. So they think they're going to teach the middle school girls about life, and they find that the middle school girls teach them. Early adolescents are very wise. They just don't know how to articulate it very well. So we teach, for example, the ABCs of problem solving. Acknowledge there's a problem. Then B is breathe. Just take a deep breath so that you can let your mind catch up to your emotions. And then C is choose a different choice, is what we call it. So ABCs, acknowledge, breathe, and choose.
That's fabulous. As a matter of fact, there are a number of these Young Women Leader Program sites, not just where your school is.
Right. So we have 11 groups here, and there are 12 sister sites nationally, and we have two international sites, one in Mozambique and three in Cameroon. How magical it is when girls and women support each other. I don't think we get enough reinforcement or support for that.
That story was produced by With Good Reason, a production of the University of Virginia. Find out more about the Young Women's Leadership Program at twlp.virginia.edu. Coming up, food safety, food quality, and food economics. That's the focus of the Food Tank. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1235. If there's one thing all humans share, it is the need for food. Yet that food can be a wall, an obstacle, or a bridge. It can mean survival and health, or contribute to disease and an early death. Food Tank, a think tank devoted to the issues surrounding food, is a new organization hoping to highlight how hunger, obesity, climate change, unemployment, and other problems can be solved by more research and investment in agriculture. I spoke with co-founder Danielle Nirenberg.
The Food Think Tank is an organization that's really focused on changing the metrics of how we measure what a successful food system looks like. For so long, the world has really focused on calories and yields and not considered, for example, the nutritional quality of crops. Most of the investment has really been in starchy staple crops rather than other nutritious foods like vegetables. Most food systems don't consider the environmental sustainability of cropping systems and whether they contribute to enhancing soils or protecting water supplies. And most of our production doesn't consider whether a food system empowers youth or helps improve gender equity. So the Food Tank is really a way to create more dialogue and conversation around food system issues and really come up with creative ways to change those metrics and really focus on better ways of producing food that help alleviate hunger and poverty while also protecting the environment. My partner in Food Tank, Ellen Gustafson, and I have combined 20 years experience talking about food issues. My time has been spent mostly on the ground in developing countries, talking to farmers and farmers' groups, researchers and scientists, policymakers and government leaders, youth groups, NGOs, journalists, and academics, and really collecting their thoughts on what's working on the ground. Over the last couple of years, I've visited more than 35 countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and again, really finding the innovations that are best practices that are working, that are often not getting the attention and the support and ultimately the funding and investment that they need to be replicated and scaled up.
Can you give me an example of one of those things?
Absolutely. In India, I had the opportunity to visit with members of the Self-Employed Women's Association. That's one of the largest unions in the world with more than 1 million members. And these women have done some innovative things around food production. Not only are they growing their crops organically, they're growing rice and vegetables and fruits and spices with organic methods like vermiculture or worm composting and natural pesticides. They've also developed their own brand that they're selling to low-income residents in urban areas. Urban residents often spend up to 80% of their incomes on food, and often it's low-quality food. And the Sewa marketing is marketing to them to make sure that they have good quality food and an affordable price. But this is, you know, a really interesting example of showing how farmers are not just producers of food. They're also businesswomen, and they are teachers in their communities, really spreading their innovations to other farmers and other business people. And they're stewards of the land who can use agroecological practices to increase yields while also protecting the environment. Often when we're talking about food system issues, you realize that agricultural economists aren't talking to agronomists, or that dietitians and nutritionists aren't talking to farmers. And we really want to break down those silos with Food Tank and make sure that those folks are talking to one another, that they're getting the information that they need to make better decisions, and that ultimately innovations in agriculture are replicated and scaled up on a big scale, so that we're doing, you know, we're achieving this mission of alleviating hunger and poverty while also protecting the environment. So the role of Food Tank is really to create a dialogue and a platform for these different players to interact and to change policy and to change practices.
Danielle Nierenberg is the co-founder of the Food Tank, a nonprofit think tank devoted to exploring issues related to the global food system. Find out more at foodtank.org. March is not just a month when we remember women's history or celebrate International Women's Day. Omega Women's Leadership Center Director Carla Goldstein says we should be thinking about a collaborative future.
International Women's Day, commemorated around the world on March 8th, was initiated at the turn of the 20th century by women involved in the labor movement in the United States and Europe. They wanted to bring attention to the unfair working conditions of women, build support for universal suffrage, and end gender discrimination. Every year, in celebration of International Women's Day, women's organizations around the world host events during the month of March to raise awareness and catalyze change. The time has come to build a stronger partnership between women and men, a partnership that acknowledges and embraces our interdependence, and a partnership that builds on our mutual interests in achieving gender equality. With so much important work still to accomplish, including ending gender violence, creating pay equity, and having equal representation in the institutions that shape our world, we need each other as allies. And beyond needing allies, the kind of equality we're seeking is not just about making sure women get an equal piece of the pie. It's about creating a new pie together. The women's movement has succeeded in making visible the ways in which women suffer from gender discrimination, but men also suffer from gender inequality. And we need to bring that more fully into view because it's key to moving forward together. James O'Neill, a developmental psychologist at the University of Connecticut, says that most men think that being a man is based on four impossible rules. 1, don't be a sissy. You can never do anything that is even remotely hinting at the feminine. 2, always win. Seek wealth, power, and status. 3, be a sturdy oak. Be reliable in a crisis, like an inanimate object such as a rock, a pillar, or a tree. And 4, go for it. Be daring, aggressive, and take risks. Don't care what others think. The growing gender research on men shows that not only are these impossible personal goals to attain, but they also create a lifetime of stress and fear for boys and men that can lead to unhappiness, aggression, poor relationships, and disease. And in the public sphere, these goals can undermine building a peaceful society that aspires to take care of everybody and the planet that we live on. As Michael Kimmel, a men's studies scholar, says, quote, masculinity could be better defined by how honorable, ethical, and responsible men can be, a caretaker of his family and community and to those he loves, end quote. There are so many beautiful and powerful relationships to build on between spouses and partners, mothers and sons, fathers and daughters, co-workers and community members, to take the next step across the gender divide with new levels of curiosity, empathy, and of course, comic relief, for understanding how rigid gender roles limit all of us and how gender equality can liberate everybody.
Carla Goldstein is director of the Women's Leadership Center at the Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York. Find out more at eomega.org. And finally, Gilles Malkin closes out this show with a profile of a woman whose musical talent set new standards, and who, thankfully, can still be heard and seen thanks to modern technology.
It is said of some people that they're born to do this or born to do that, and this is intended as a high compliment. When applied to the British cellist Jacqueline Mary Dupré, it's a complete understatement. She was clearly one of the best musicians who ever lived, evident to all the world at the time and since. Born in Oxford, England, in 1945, she began her lessons at age 5, and by 11 had won her first competition. Eventually, her teachers would include the finest players in the world, such as Casals and Rostropovich. She met and married pianist-conductor Daniel Barenboim, and for a spell of some wonderful years, they were the music world's magical couple. Jacqueline was a big girl, Amazonian, some have said, but had a quiet demeanor and was forthright and honest in her self-expression. Those closest to her say she had a focus upon what is deepest in life, to the extent that she knew nothing of many of life's everyday practical details. Jacqueline had a musical style of emotional abandon that reached people and reached them with meaning, with depth, and with joy. Her gift included not only a natural aptitude for her instrument, but innate musical instincts, a musical sensitivity that elevated others who were playing with her and that entranced her audiences. She had mastery over the entire range of her instrument. She could make her cello whisper or erupt ferociously, and she was completely committed to the romanticism of the music she loved best. Jacqueline sometimes played with Barenboim and violinist Pinchas Zukerman, who was completely electrified by her. On occasions at which they played together, he felt she guided the music by a marvelous sort of telepathy, and the result was a living spontaneity akin to magic. This happened with other performances as well, some even caught on film for the world to keep. To remember this very unusual level of chemistry that occurred through her and amplified the quality of the playing of everyone around her. Jacqueline Dupré became famous for her rendition of the Elgar Cello Concerto, a beautiful and meditative piece, and her recording has become the definitive rendition of that work. It's so human that a person of such incredible talent, a person so loving and lovable as to have changed the lives of so many who met her, take on a degree of tragedy that renders our memories of that person poignant and bittersweet. Jacqueline's career was cut short by the onset of multiple sclerosis at the age of 26. She began to notice that her fingers could not always feel the strings of her instruments. Whereas a cellist learns to play by feel, there came a time when she had to play by looking at her fingers to move them from note to note. She continued playing for as long as she could, until it became evident that her performance level had diminished beyond what was acceptable to her. By age 28, she'd completely stopped performing. She continued her involvement in music as a teacher and became personally involved with the fight against MS. She never lost her enthusiasm for life and the new discoveries every day can bring. After she could no longer play, she drew immense gratification from discovering the music of words and poetry. Musicians may become excellent at their business, but only a gifted few are imbued with a creative spirit that takes music or any art to a wider level, a level at which the art touches everyone, coming to us on warm, evocative winds from a deep, more meaningful part of life where understanding has an immediate and universal quality, a spirit that truly exemplifies the precious value of those who can lead us there. Such was the genius of Jacqueline Dupré, who died of MS in 1987 at the age of 42. Thank you for listening. For 51% and Women in History, I'm Gilles Malkin.
Gilles Malkin is an actor, writer, and musician. He lives in New York's Catskill Mountains. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.